When the poet John Balaban served as a conscientious objector in Vietnam, he had no idea this was the beginning of a path he would follow to retirement and a 2017 award for Outstanding Community Service in Literature from AWP, the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. His 12 books of poetry, prose, and translations include his selected poems, Locusts at the Edge of Summer, winner of the 1998 William Carlos Williams Award, and the surprising poetic bestseller, Spring Essence, his translations of an 18th century Vietnamese concubine, Ho Xuan Hung. We'll hear from both those books today on this archive, New Letters on the Air, produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with John Balaban in 2002 at Rutgers University's Midwest Poet Series about crafting his poetry translations.
Some of the first ones I ever did, I included in the new and selected poems as well.
You can see a little bit of the creative process by looking at one of those poems and how it changed. In Locusts at the Edge of Summer, I might get you to read it because
sure.
It's a very short poem called Autumn Landscape.
Drop by drop, rain slaps the banana leaves. Praise whoever's skill sketched this desolate scene. The lush dark canopies of the gnarled trees, the long river sliding smooth and white. Tilting my wine flask, I am drunk with rivers and hills. My bag, filled with wind and moonlight, weighs on my back, sags with poems, look and love. Even men, whoever sees this landscape, is stunned.
Yeah, I changed it.
You did change it. It's interesting. And I'm going to get you to read the new one to hear them back to back.
Okay. Obviously, I'm not a native speaker of the language, and these are poems that are 200 years old. And as I got better at it, I revised even some poems that were in print. So, drop by drop, rain slaps the banana leaves. Praise whoever sketched this desolate scene. The lush dark canopies of the gnarled trees, the long river sliding smooth and white. I lift my wine flask, drunk with rivers and hills. My backpack, breathing moonlight, sags with poems. Look and love everyone, whoever sees this landscape. Is stunned. One big difference is everyone look and love, even men. Men, the first time round, is accurate if you think of men as humankind. She wasn't specifically making the impossibility of affection for men the point of that line. But her disappointment with men in her own lifetime is a theme in almost all of her poems. So I pushed the poem that way, and then I realized it really wasn't an honest translation that way. That would be misinterpreted. And she really is talking from a Mahayana Buddhist compassionate viewpoint, and she really means everyone, men, women, every sentient being. And then there, I guess, there's some other things about that as well.
But yeah, I think you call it a backpack, and in this one you say my bag.
Yeah.
You know, just little things like that.
Yeah, little things that just sharpen the focus, make it clear. What's it say in that line? You read the
it says, my bag filled with wind and moonlight weighs on my back, sags with poems.
Yeah. No, yeah, there's a change. It's now a backpack. I wanted readers to have a sense of how she was carrying it. The first version is more literal. It says wind and moonlight, and now I have it breathing moonlight, and I sort of put the wind into the participle there as well. Here it is in the original. Tan tot tao tiêu, my hat mua. Can I ke ve can tiusha? Shan call to trun sway tan. Trung swa trang yang fang lang ta. Bao yap yang shan shai chap ru. Tui lung fung wet nang yi ta. A hai can kung ung ui nyi. Ai tai ai ma chang ngang nga. Which is more or less what it sounds like in Vietnamese.
That's lovely.
But the first line is really amazing. Listen to it in Vietnamese. He's talking about drop by drop, rain slaps the banana leaves. And it's not a bad translation because it captures the sound of water hitting leaves, but it's much more delicate in the original. Tan tot tao tiêu. It's just a...
It sounds like rain.
It sounds like
doesn't
rain.
Doesn't it? Vietnamese is such a musical language.
It's tonal language.
I had no idea until your reading when you were talking about the six different tones. You can have as many as six different meanings for the same word. And I was fascinated by that.
If you say the syllable la, it means to shout. If you say la, it's the verb to be. If you say la, it's tired. If you say la, it's insipid. La, leaf. La, strange.
Well, before we go any further, I wanted you to talk about what brought you to deal so much with Vietnam. And I know that you were in Harvard graduate school in 1967 when something happened that really changed your life. And I wondered if you'd tell us that story.
It was a single event. But of course, if you are old enough to remember those times, you remember how wrought up the entire country was and how difficult it was to go about your daily job, whatever it might be, especially for youngsters as I was at that point. So I was in graduate school and really enjoying myself. I had a free ride to Harvard, and I was studying Old English and Middle Scots and having a great time in Latin. I was coming out of the library, passing Lowell House through that back alley, and there was a huge noise, the sound of lots of people, and I knew something was going on, so I walked around to see what it was about. And there was a news camera team there and a huge crowd, and they had trapped a big limousine in the alley. And in the limousine was Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. And I don't think they were even intentionally blocking the car, but inevitably they did. And McNamara got out. I stood behind the cameraman and the sound man, figuring that was a safe place if there was trouble. And I was not really interested in getting involved. He got up on his car, and I remember the sound of the hood buckling, and the crowd hushed. And McNamara said, "I have just a few minutes to give you. I have appointments, and I want to say just a few things. When I was a student at Berkeley, I was just as radical as you, but there was one difference. I was far more polite. Catcalls, as you can imagine, came from the crowd. The sound man winked to the cameraman because he had gotten all the verbal insults, and that's all they wanted. They clicked off and went away, and McNamara got back in his car and drove away. And I thought, what incredible arrogance and what a clever manipulation of that crowd. He knew he could get his attention by that drama of stepping up there. He knew he was in no danger, and he baited that crowd, insulted them, and then drove off and got away with it. Harvard apologized the next day in the papers, and I went into this personal sweat. It just troubled me. It seemed to me that a government official, when a war was being conducted in our country's name, should be held to account or at least answer some questions from the public. And that's all that was about. They were asking that he speak, and he refused to say anything. And at that time, which was, 1967, the U.S. was saying there were a few hundred civilian casualties and they were being paid compensation and taken care of. It was an immense, ugly lie. I wrote to my draft board and said I wanted to change my status from student deferment to conscientious objector. And they wrote back and said that wasn't wise to do. It was rather sweet of them. And I insisted on a hearing, and I went to Vietnam as a civilian conscientious objector.
Did you have any idea of the import of this for the rest of your life?
Not the least. I thought I was giving away 2 years of my life. That was the length of time. And that when it was over, I'd go back to Harvard and start my studies again. But, of course, that never happened.
You are still a conscientious objector, though in your work, I do get the sense that there are times when you realize that you need to fight. Is that right?
That's right. I don't know that the Quakers that sheltered my views when I was a youngster pleading conscientious objection would be too happy with how my views were finally expressed. I was wounded in Vietnam, and I was wounded carrying a machine gun because I had agreed to defend an operating room in a hospital. That was kind of a quandary I didn't anticipate getting into. And, you know, I thought if you were a conscientious objector, you simply refuse to take human life. But it's always not so simple with human beings, isn't it? I came during the Tet Offensive. I talk about this in a memoir that's called Remembering Heaven's Face. There's that episode in the book with these other young men from voluntary agencies. We went to volunteer at the hospital during the offensive because we knew there'd be a lot of wounded people. And we got to a courtyard. It was like a scene in the Atlanta Railway at Gone with the Wind. Oh, just a sea of people lying in the dirt, all shot up and mangled from the battle going on around the city at the time. And as we walked in, there was an American surgical team, military doctors, who were leaving. And we sort of bumped into each other, and they said, well, who are you? And we said, well, where are you going? And they said, we can't operate here. I said, they're Viet Cong on the grounds, and you can't operate if someone's going to stick a gun through, you know, the operating door. And then they paused. They said, well, we'll stay if you guard the operating room. And this was very perplexing because I was a conscientious objector. My friend Roger Hinsey, who was this farm boy from Idaho, and there was a guy named Bill Sorrell, black American from Harlem, who also was opposed to the war and had no interest in killing anybody. But all three of us ended up with guns and guarded the operating room while there was a battle raging just outside the wall. So that was a confusing moment. I think since then I've modified. I mean, if we hadn't done that, the people who were lying in that dusty courtyard just would have died. A lot of them died anyway.
It's so hard because there's that line between taking a life and protecting.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so
it's not always so easy.
It's not so black and white, is it?
No. So I don't know about being a conscientious objector.
And what you discovered amidst all the pain and suffering, because you dealt a lot with the doctors and the nurses, and
I was the field representative for a group that evacuated war injured children to the United States, and we treated them. Our charter was we could only treat children under 18 years of age, and that they had to be war injuries and children who required skin grafts and multiple surgeries.
You've got quite a few poems that address this. Locust at the Edge of Summer is divided into three parts, and the first part is called Speak Memory, and that's where the bulk of your Vietnam poems are.
Right.
And then you've got Riding Westward, which deals more with your travels in our country, and then Viewing the World Order. And I thought I'd have you do something out of that first part. We could do the title poem of your first book, After Our War.
I'll do this one called Thoughts Before Dawn, partly because my finger just hit on it. But also it's about those children and about a young woman. We sent the children out of Vietnam on U.S. Air Force hospital airplanes when there is a space available. And we sent them always with a Vietnamese woman who was trained in social work, or when we couldn't find someone who actually had social work training, somebody who seemed decent and able to translate and who we could trust to stay with the children. And also, if you think of putting a war-injured child onto an airplane filled with war-injured soldiers when they can't even speak English, that would have been a horrifying moment.
That would be horrifying.
So Mary Cui, this poem is for her. Thoughts Before Dawn, for Mary Bowie T. Cui, 1944 to 1969. The bare oaks rock and snow crust tumbles down. The creaking eave woke me thinking of you crushed by a truck 13 years ago when a drunk Arvin lost the wheel. We brought to better care the nearly lost, the boy burned by white phosphorus, chin glued to his chest, the scalped girl, the triple amputee from the road mine bus, the kid without a jaw, the one with no nose. You never wept in front of them, but waited until the gurney rolled them into surgery. I guess that's what amazed me most. Why didn't you fall apart or quit? Once we flew to Patch Kid's home, getting in by Army Chopper, a Huey black cat that skimmed the sea. When the gunner opened up on a whale, you closed your eyes and covered your ears, and your small body shook in your silk ao yai. Oh, Mary, in this Arctic night I lie in my bed and rehearse your smile, bright white teeth, the funny way you rode your Honda 50, perched so straight, silky hair bunned up in a brim hat, front brim blown back, and dark glasses. Brave woman, I hope you never saw the truck.
Thoughts Before Dawn. That comes from the book Locust at the Edge of Summer, new and selected poems by John Balaban. And you're listening to New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam. Would you like to read After the War, or is that
I hesitate. It's just an old poem. And
okay.
Well, it's the title poem from my first book, and I guess I should be happy about it.
Well, you included it in your collection here. I thought you'd be happy about all of these.
Well, that's true enough. I don't know. The person who wrote those poems, I hardly recognize him anymore. And he was an angrier Balaban than the one who sits before you now.
Yeah.
And there was a great deal of resentment in that poem. I came back from the war, even though I wasn't a soldier, probably as disoriented as many combat soldiers were. And I wondered how well I could even adapt. And my solution was partly settled for me. I started teaching at Penn State as an instructor, teaching grammar and basic English comp courses. I began these hitchhiking trips across the U.S. The first one, with a broken leg, I had broken a foot in a faculty grad student baseball game, sliding in the home plate. I scored, but the big lummox that I knocked over landed on my foot and just smashed all the little bones. And so there I was. All my friends were in Vietnam. This was like 1970, I think. And the war was still going on. And it's very odd. Even if you were opposed to a war, there is a kind of excitement, I guess you could call it, of living at the edge of one. And here I was with a broken leg. It was June. It was hot. Thought I'd go crazy that summer if I just stayed home. So I developed this, what I think was a culturally innovative idea. I got a CB walkie-talkie, and I went out on Route 80. My wife dropped me off on Route 80. I had a backpack, crutches, my foot in a cast.
I can't believe you did this on crutches. I did not realize
and,
that.
And hitchhiked across the U.S. that way. I had a great time. And in a sense, it was brilliant in that it sort of re-inoculated me with America. I found that, in fact, I liked my fellow Americans more than I had rage against them. So a lot of that middle part of the book of Locust, in fact, is about just hitchhiking and talking to people along the way.
Riding westward, it's got such an American feel. There's kind of a mystical bent, one that also has a nice form to it. Is Peyote Villanelle?
Oh, sure.
And then the piece that follows right after it is more a piece of prose, The Gift of the Morning Water. There's something nice about those two together.
Let me read them.
Okay.
I was in New Mexico, and there's a Native American church group, and I think I went to one of the ceremonies. It must have been in the lower part of Colorado. I think we drove up a little bit, and there was a road chief in a peyote ceremony, someone who guides the event, and there's a fire chief, someone who keeps the fire going in the middle of the teepee, for which there's a sand altar and some peyote buttons. And the fire chief watches the door so that people don't wander off and hurt themselves, and also make sure that people who aren't part of that group, which sort of closes its admittance at dusk, and the doors open again in the morning. But of course, people have to pee, and sometimes they have to vomit if they've eaten a lot of peyote.
Yeah.
So he has to let them in and out and make sure they're okay. And at one point, the road chief, who was a Tiwa Indian from Taos Pueblo, said, "Watch out for this one, USA." Peyote Villanelle. Trail lost, he looked about across the bouldered canyon floor. In desert waste, the soul cries out. Then echoes back in dusty shouts, wavering ghost and chaparral. The trail lost, he looked about the creek bed where he shot his mount. Horseflies suck the splash of gore. In desert waste, the soul cries out. Though no one heard, he called out loud. Snakes uncurled in a cave's cool door. The trail lost, he looked about and shuffled forth, dry in mouth, aching for home and green remora. In desert waste, the soul cries out. In blind canyons, under blank sky, scouting for water, throat parched and sore. With the trail lost, he looked about desert waste, the soul cries out. Part 2. Come, eat peyote, and you shall live. The woman waved and called him on. A god has made this road a gift. She crossed the arroyo and came to him, cloaked in light and shakes of rain. Come, eat peyote, and you shall live. Her fingers brushed his blistered lips. She talked like water, touched like dawn. A god had made the road a gift. For in that realm of scorpion and snake, his soul cried out, and the woman came, fashioned from light and veiled in rain. He followed a god through desert wastes. The gift of morning water, there's a true story. The notion of peyote as a sacramental medicine is that during some tribal upheaval, the tribe was scattered and women and children were out in the wastelands and they had nothing to eat or drink. And then one woman discovered peyote and brought it back as a medicine to the tribe. So the first person that comes into the teepee after the peyote ceremony is the woman who brings morning water. And it's a woman who just carries a huge steel bucket of water and everyone drinks from it. The kettle drum, there's like a iron kettle with a skin over it. That's the drum. It's been drummed all night long and people have sung songs with it. It's filled with water. It has this wonderful growly sound to it. And that water is spilled into the bucket as well, and people drink that as well. So you drink the drumming, as it were. So this is called The Gift of Morning Water. It's just a prose recollection. After the long night with the cold wind riffling the scrim of the teepee, lit like a lantern on the deserted prairie, a night of chills in the small of the back, aches and cross legs, after all the hours of chanting from Indians and Anglos, after their drumming on the iron kettle stretched with hide, its water-filled belly bellowing when tipped, after the prayers sung for forgiveness, for guidance from the grandfather peyote on the crescent of sand, after chewing bitter buttons, swallowing dry powder, after the drumming and the singing and the sweet sage thrown onto the dazzling fire, as the embers died and dawn finally rinsed the top of the tent, the road chief, an elderly Tiwa, who throughout the night had asked him to show us the right road, said, "A woman is coming with morning water. Listen to her. She is your mother." An old Pueblo woman crawled through the tent flap, short of breath and shoving before her on the teepee sand a steel bucket, water sloshing, ladle clanking, and I turned with exhaustion, with disappointment. For all night long I had sat eating the medicine, going out only once under the huge roaring stars to take a leak and return, and nothing really had happened. And then she spoke with puffy, tired lips, said, "You have done a good thing here tonight. Drink this water and be refreshed." And every syllable that came from her was perfectly the voice of my own mother, dead these many years. Stunned and now weeping, I sat as the bucket came around to me, wept hard at hearing her voice again. I have a friend in Vermont who, for a full week after his father's death, kept calling the family answering machine just to hold a bit longer to his father's voice. And here I was made a gift. I hadn't known how much I wanted. The voice that called my name the first morning of my life.
The Gift of Morning Water. And before that, we heard Peyote Villanelle by John Balaban from his book Locusts at the Edge of Summer, New and Selected Poems. This is New Letters on the Air. It's wonderful how these poems move from piece to piece, and they're not always linked, but there's like this touching.
You want that to happen.
Yeah, you do.
I mean, a book of poetry is probably a collection of short lyric poems, but you'd like to create the illusion, or at least express the truth, that these lyric poems have a direction to them and that they're going somewhere. And it's not as if the reader's reading a novel where there's a plot with a resolution, but at least there's a direction in these poems. And for me, with landscapes as varied as Vietnam and a peyote ceremony in southern Colorado, it's hard to make that direction apparent. But they do, yeah. I'm glad you noticed that.
Talk some about your use of form.
My interest in translating Vietnamese has made me more convinced that there isn't any talking about poetry without talking about form. It's the whole issue. Form being essentially the arrangement of rhythm in my mind. And there are lots of ways of doing that, traditionally and untraditionally. But the importance of being conscious of it is the whole heart of the poem, as far as I can tell. So with that first one I read to you, the Villanelle, that's, 19 lines long, works on two rhymes that alternate. The first line of the first stanza and the third line of the first stanza alternate in their appearance as the final lines of subsequent stanzas, and then at the very end they all come together. There's something about that form that has a kind of cyclical, repetitive quality where every time you make a turn, it's not a mere repetition, but the sound is the same, but something new is being said. So you have the sense of inching forward by degrees, of understanding something slowly, which is appropriate for some kinds of poems. And so against that, there's that prose piece where I wanted to talk in a different way. But yeah, I think it's absolutely important. I used to hesitate to give my students exercises, formal exercises, but now I do it all the time. And after years of teaching and finding that some of the best poems they do, in fact, are responses to formal exercises, I don't hesitate anymore.
Well, I have one more poem I'd like to get you to read called In Celebration of Spring. And it's in the last section of Locust at the Edge of Summer. I should point out, too, that this is from the third and final part, Viewing the New World Order.
Right.
Which has a lot of looking back at the old world order, too.
It has a lot of looking back at world order. Obviously, we're no clearer what the new world order is now than we were before. Our Asian war is over. Others have begun. Our elders who tried to mortgage lies are disgraced or dead. And already the brokers are picking their pockets for the keys and the credit cards. In Delta Swamp, in a united Vietnam, a Marine with a bullfrog for a face rots in equatorial heat. An eel slides through the cage of his bared ribs. At night, on the old battlefields, ghosts like patches of fog lurk into villages to maunder on doorsills of cratered homes, while all across the USA, the wounded walk about and wonder where to go. And today, in the simmer of lyric sunlight, the chrysalis pulses in its mushy cocoon under the bark on a gnarled root of an elm. In the brilliant creek, a minnow flashes, delirious with gnats. The turtle's heart quickens its taps in the warm bank sludge. As she chases a frisbee spinning in sunlight, a girl's breasts bounce full and strong. A boy's stomach, as he turns, is flat and strong. Swear by the locust, by dragonflies on ferns, by the minnow's flash, the tremble of a breast, by the new earth spongy under our feet, that as we grow old we will not grow evil, that although our garden seeps with sewage and our elders think it's up for auction, swear by this dazzle that does not wish to leave us, that we will be keepers of a garden nonetheless.
John Balaban, reading from his book Locust at the Edge of Summer, from Copper Canyon Press, the publisher of his Vietnamese translation, Spring Essence, and his 2006 book, Path, Crooked Path. Three new poems by John Balaban are in the current 2017 issue of New Letters magazine. More poetry about Vietnam is available from our sister publisher here at UMKC, Bookmark Press, which recently released Feet of the Messenger by veteran H.C. Palmer. By the way, the press has an annual book competition. Here's editor Robert Stewart with more.
I invite you to send your unpublished book of poetry or short fiction to us at BKMK Press, pronounced Bookmark. We will consider it for publication and a possible $1,000 publication award. Send your book manuscript by January 15 online or by post to Bookmark Press.
A link to the contest and this year's winners are posted under News on our website, newletters.org. There you can hear more by this poet, as well as subscribe to the magazine or our free podcast. Today's show, recorded when John Balaban read at Rockhurst University's 2002 Midwest Poet Series, was originally produced with Linda Scher and Sarah Lerner. Thanks also to Dennis Conroe, Alex Smith, and now Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.